Welcome to the Fund the People podcast. I'm your host, Rusty Stahl. We all know that philanthropy and nonprofits do an extraordinary amount of good, but we also know that our system isn't working as well as it should. We all know that people drive change, but too many nonprofit people feel less like drivers and more like roadkill. Since the year 2000, I've worked in organized philanthropy and nonprofits where I've focused on leadership and professional development. I've studied the lack of investment in our nonprofit leaders and workers, and how our systems of grant making, fundraising, governance, and management reinforce the lack of support or can transform it. When we invest in our people, we can create a more equitable and effective sector, fueled by rising levels of performance, impact, and sustainability. To bring that vision to life, in 2014, I helped to launch Fund the People, the national campaign to maximize investment in America's nonprofit workforce. Our podcast shares critical ideas, stories, and conversations about how organizations and their funders are strengthening their work by investing in the people who do the work. So buckle up, start your engines, and let's get driving. All right. Welcome, everybody, to Fund the People, a podcast with me, Rusty Stahl, your host. Glad you're here. Hope you're having a great day. I'm thrilled to have Nell Edgington with us. Nell has 25 years of experience in the social change sector, and she runs a consulting practice called Social Velocity, which helps nonprofit and philanthropic leaders become more confident, strategic, and financially savvy at creating social change. In addition to leading Social Velocity, Nell writes and speaks extensively about moving the nonprofit sector and the funding community to become more effective at creating social change. And she's author of a new book called Reinventing Social Change, Embracing Abundance to Create a Healthier and More Equitable World. And she also writes her popular blog, Social Velocity, and has contributed to many print and online journals in the space. She's a member of the LEAP Ambassadors community. And if you don't know about that, you should check them out. It's a network of 250 nonprofit and funder leaders working to create a high-performing social change sector. So Nell, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, you know, it's great to have you here because the book is just awesome. It is full of stories as well as ideas, and I loved it. So I'm really glad it exists in the world. It was helpful to me to read it personally. I was like, So thank you for your work as a consultant and as a thought leader.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, Nell, tell us a little bit about your leadership and career journey. How did you get from birth to this podcast conversation? What motivated you to join the field? And how did you end up creating Social Velocity?
Yeah. Well, so I would say that my interest in the social change sector started pretty early, although I never would have referred to it that way or really even understood it. But when I was 14, I did a week-long service camp at a homeless shelter. And kind of from that moment, my interest in, you know, questioning why are people homeless or why are there are these problems in the world and how do we address it, that was sort of born from that moment. And I have spent my entire career since I graduated from college in the social change sector, working in various social change organizations, arts and media, food bank, education, all kinds of different arenas. And I started Social Velocity about 12 years ago because I became, over the course of that time in the social change sector, became increasingly frustrated by the scarcity that I saw, by these hurdles that were put in the way of people who were, you know, had amazing visions for creating a better world, for taking care of us and the planet in much more effective ways. But they were hindered, you know, time and time again, a lack of money, a lack of board members, a lack of staff, a lack of resources, a lack of influence. So I became increasingly frustrated by that and really felt that I could offer a way to sort of help that bridge that divide from what I saw as scarcity to, you know, really having everything you need to achieve these amazing social change visions.
So the book really is kind of a culmination of that experience and thinking throughout your career.
Yeah, I think it is. I over that time, you know, I really crystallized. And, you know, when I first started Social Velocity 12 years ago, I didn't really know the words scarcity or abundance in terms of the social change concept. That, you know, I understood it, but I hadn't really articulated it and hadn't really articulated what the path from one to the other would be. And so over the course of my 12 years of working with, you know, just some amazing social change leaders, I sort of started to crystallize what that path looks like and how it can be really effective.
And how did you come to turn that into the book? Like, what was the, I can see what the impetus was to share some of that thinking, but what was the moment where you said, yes, I'm going to put this into a book and begin?
Well, so I went through kind of a dark period after the Trump election in 2016. You know, like a lot of social change leaders, it was really a blow. I, like so many folks, had spent, you know, my whole career trying to move our country and our world to a healthier and more equitable place. And the Trump election just felt like such a blow against treating people well and making people more equal. And so I kind of took a step back after that election and stopped writing the blog for a while. Just took a lot of time to reflect and figure out, like, how do I fit in this? How is social change relevant anymore in the face of, you know, what just happened to our country? And so it took me, you know, a while to kind of make my way back. I did a lot of reading, a lot of writing, a lot of thinking. And from that, this book, I think, really emerged, because it's truly my process too. You know, they always say you write the book you need to read. And so I really felt that the process of writing the book was me sort of saying, hey, here's the way back. Here's the way back from feeling like such a crushing blow. How do we even continue with this to, you know what, we can really change the world.
Wow. Yeah, that's very powerful. You know, so many people, I think, in our sector felt back on their heels, knocked back, you know, and not because, you know, some partisan thing, but because so many of the issues and communities that we care about and so many of the policies people have been working on or issues were being rolled back by decades and decades and, you know, undermined and just tossed aside.
Well, and the rhetoric too, so divisive. So, you know, pitting people against each other. I mean, that's just not the world I want to live in. And I don't think it's the world that most people want to live in. It was, you know, it's challenging to move beyond that.
Yeah, it's going to take a while. We're still obviously in the thick of it, really. Thank you for sharing a bit about your journey. And now we'll dive into the book. On this podcast, we try to bring in, you know, funder voices, nonprofit voices, and those intermediaries, researchers, scholars, you know, consultants who are kind of supporting and pushing the field. And so your position right there, working, you know, with the philanthropic and nonprofit community in the book, you know, really addresses the dynamics among all these players. You know, and I want to make sure we touch on some of the issues that really connect between the idea of talent investing, some of the things that hold back talent investing from happening, and some of the things that folks could do to increase their investments in themselves and their teams. So what I think will be helpful is, you know, the book is fairly tightly organized into 5 chapters. So I think we could just go through and you could share a little bit about each area, and people need to read the book to get all the nuance and the stories. But yeah, so let's start with part one is to recognize the system is broken. So tell us what you mean.
So I believe that the social change sector, both the nonprofit organizations working within it and the philanthropy that funds it, the sector is fundamentally broken. We have a dysfunctional power dynamic between those doing the work and those funding the work. And it honestly, it holds social change back. So the first step is for both all social change leaders, and I define that very broadly, nonprofit leaders, philanthropic leaders, government agency decision makers, corporate social responsibility folks, anyone that is moving people or money to social change, I believe is a social change leader. And step one is for social change leaders to recognize that the system, not themselves, are broken. And I know you talk about this a lot and think about this a lot. It's really about the people. And so if we can start with social change leaders themselves feeling much more empowered, and we do that by uncovering, many of the dysfunctions that go way, way back. This is not something that started today, but there are historical roots that have brought us to where we are today. If we can understand that, uncover those, then individual social leaders can start to chart a new path forward.
Yeah, and you talk about some of the underlying kind of worldviews that we carry, like the idea of charity and all of its implications. Who does charity? Who benefits from charity? How charity operates? So that's something that I think about a lot, and you talk about how it has sexist roots. And so I wondered if you could share a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the modern day, today's social change sector emerged from the benevolence movements of the 18th and 19th century, where it was largely women whose only public role was allowed, to be out kind of feeding the hungry, clothing the needy, providing those benevolence things. But their work was funded by the profits from the business and government sector. And their work was largely regulated by those male-dominated sectors. It was fine to do, their nice charity work as long as they didn't undermine the overall system, as long as they didn't question the fact that, why are there hungry people? Why are there people who don't have a place to stay? So that's kind of the historical underpinnings of the sector that we are in today. And it's largely stayed the same in terms of that dynamic. 75% of the nonprofit workforce is female. And the vast majority of leadership positions in the private and government sector are male. And those funds, government and private money, largely fund the nonprofit sector. And there are regulations around nonprofit work that are not true in the private sector. We allow the private sector to do so many more things: how they use their funding, how they raise funding, how they are, their political activity is regulated. All of those things are much more lax for the private sector than they are for the nonprofit sector. And that's a huge disparity that I believe is rooted in the history of the sector.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I talk about in the talent investing framework that I've been developing is the deficit of investment in the nonprofit workforce is kind of a cycle. And you talk about cycles like the starvation cycle. That cycle of underinvestment is driven by, sexism, like you say, racism, class. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a whole set of things. Some of the things that were rooted in good ideas, there are positive attributes, obviously, to volunteerism and charity and all those things, but they also have these problematic sides as well, very deeply problematic sides. Mm-hmm. The gender dynamics of the sector are real. So let's talk about the next part of the book, reclaiming our power, even though it's mm-hmm. called Reclaim Your Power, right? Tell us about that. How do we begin to move beyond the broken system and claim our power?
Social change leaders, spend so much time looking outside of themselves, rightly so, because, their whole purpose, I think, is to say, hey, that's wrong. The way we're doing this is wrong. The way we're treating people is wrong. We're leaving people behind. That's wrong. We need to fix that. So they spend so much time very positively looking at, what are the inconsistencies or inadequacies in the world. But I think the opportunity to really step into your power is to come back internally, to come back to, as I say, reclaim your power. Because of the historical roots of the sector, the sexism, and all of the things that have held the nonprofit sector back, because of that, social change leaders have really become very powerless. They feel so restricted by lack of money and, you know, regulations and all sorts of things. So the challenge is to break out of that and to get back to the social change you really want to do. Get back to that passion. What got you up in the morning when you first started the work? What is that vision you have for a better world that can really get you going? That's sort of the seed of your power. Getting back in touch with your own needs. You know, I even include Maslow's hierarchy of needs in the book simply because it is so forgotten in the social change sector. And I'm sure you see this all the time. But, you know, nonprofit leaders are so good at denying their own needs. You know, they'll skip bathroom breaks and they'll skip meals. They, you know, don't go to the doctor. There just isn't enough time. We've got to work, 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 work. And that's a way to really undermine your own power. So in this chapter, I talk about ways to connect back into your joy and passion, to think again about your needs and start to meet those, to claim your value. I think so often in the nonprofit sector, you know, we think, oh, we're just doing good work. You know, we're so self-effacing. But if you can claim back that value that you create, you know, you're providing tremendous value to your communities, to the country, to the world. Get in touch with that and reclaim that. That is also a path back to your power.
Power is there, and the system and we ourselves are underselling it, undermining it, underutilizing it.
Mm-hmm. Restricting it. Yep.
Restricting it. I think that's something that comes up throughout the book is the restriction. There's both external restriction, but then this kind of internalized restriction.
We are making social change leaders and they are making themselves small, unnecessarily small. And now more than ever in the wake of the pandemic, we need social change leaders to be big, really big. And so we need to move beyond that. We need them to break out of those restrictions, to break out of that feeling of, you know, I need to be small, and to really claim their place in this world.
You get into some new age stuff. Let's just own that, right? No, but you have this section about your center is the core of your being. Yep. Your gut, your inner knowing, your intuition, that place where a deeper knowledge of who you are and your right path exists. You find your center by creating a regular space by yourself. Can you talk about that? How do you, as a consultant, help nonprofit folks find that regular space by yourself?
It's different for everyone. I'll be honest with you. I can't tell a nonprofit leader, like, where is that place of joy or centeredness or whatever it is for you? But we can start to sort of unpack it. So I have a client, for example, that loves to hike. You know, she just absolutely loves to hike, but she often will deny herself that joy. Oh, I'm just so busy. My schedule's packed, you know, that sort of thing. Great. Let's carve out a place. Where is an hour? So you start small. Where is a 30-minute chunk in your calendar where you could go for a hike? What does that look like? And then from there, you start to build and see, wow, I was so much more productive after I had that 30-minute hike or that hour-long hike. And then it starts to become something that you can regularly devote yourself to, because you start to recognize how much more powerful you are, how much more engaged you are, how much more productive you are when you carve out that time to really follow your joy and to connect back in with yourself.
Yeah, hiking is a good thing. I live in the Hudson Valley where there is so much hiking available. And like this morning, I had a little time before I had to come in, and I didn't get a walk, but I drove and I parked in a park just to be by the creek. Even though I was in my car, it was still like a relaxing place to just kind of hang out for 15 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just giving yourself that permission, even if it's 15 minutes, can be amazing.
But it's really about kind of stepping back from extricating oneself from the noise, as you put it, and the pace that we're all in. Mm-hmm. And
the dysfunction. I mean, let's be honest. It's, you know, it's a dysfunctional way of, and I'm claiming this only because I have absolutely been there and I still struggle with it at times as well, is to just distance yourself from that noise and that pace and that just kind of harriedness, and come back into, you know, what drives you.
And you kind of talk about both this internal work and then also asking for help in this chapter, which comes up throughout the book. How do you mobilize help from various places? But I thought these zones that you referenced from Gay Hendricks, I guess another author, were helpful. Can you share with folks this, how to think about what they do well and where they can get help from or need to mobilize help from others?
Yeah. So, you know, I think one of the many sort of dysfunctional ethos of the nonprofit sector is that you got to do it all by yourself. It's all up to you. You got to do all the work. And that's not sustainable, and that's an enormous burden. And it's what's contributing to, you know, what I see as a lot of burnout in the sector. And so the opportunity then is to say, let's siphon off what I have no business doing, ask for help for that, and then focus in on what I am really here to do. And so you can do that through this process of looking at four zones. So the first zone is your zone of incompetence. So these are tasks that you're just really bad at. So for me, it's technology. I'll fully admit that. I hate it. Don't want to be anywhere near it. The second zone is zone of competence. So these are things, you know, you're good at, but you don't really enjoy them. And there's lots of other people that could do them. For me, that's accounting. Your third piece is your zone of excellence. So this is what you've been training for a long time. Maybe it's your educational background or your many years of experience. These are the things you're really excellent at. And then the fourth and really key is their zone of genius. This is what you're here to do. This is what lights you up. It's when you're doing this, time just sort of evaporates. You're really, really good at it. You're better than, you know, the vast majority of folks. So you want to focus in on your zone of excellence and your zone of genius. That's where you should be doing the bulk of your work. In your zone of incompetence, incompetence are things that you ask for help for, you delegate, you give to volunteer or intern, you know, you hire somebody, or you just don't do them. There's a lot of things I think in the nonprofit sector we could just simply stop doing. And so that, you know, could fall into that. So I encourage social change leaders to do this for themselves, ask their staff members to do it, could even have your board do it, to really start to think about, you know, what is each person individually here to do? What's their core contributions they could make to our larger social change vision? How do we bring all that together?
If folks can't tell, that was pretty inspirational, and the book is too. So I love how you end the chapter, says, you write, you don't need anyone's permission to be powerful. You already have inside you all the power you could ever need to achieve the social change you seek. You are powerful beyond measure. That is beautiful. Let's move to, in that spirit, kissing scarcity goodbye, which is the next section. Can you tell us how we get rid of the scarcity?
Yeah. So I think step one is just to recognize that you are in a scarcity mindset. And it's not just true for the nonprofit sector. It's also true for the philanthropic sector, government sector. All of us, I think, exist for, you know, a good chunk of the time in scarcity. And scarcity is the belief, and it is a belief. It's not a reality. It's just a belief that there is not enough. There's not enough money. There's not enough time. There are not enough people. There are not enough resources, influence, power. Whatever it is, there's not enough for me to accomplish what I want to accomplish. And so to get beyond that, you have to first start to recognize, okay, I am in scarcity, and sort of start to catch yourself when you start to say things like, oh, we just don't know how to raise money, or we just can't find enough money out there. And in a bridge that I really like to sort of have people start with is the word yet. Using yet as a bridge from scarcity to the possibility of abundance. So you take any scarcity-based sentence or concept that you come up with in your boardroom, staff room, whatever it is, we don't have enough money, and you attach the word yet to it. That exercise opens you up to the possibility that maybe there's a better way. Maybe there is something more out there. So we don't have enough money yet, but if we put together a smart fundraising plan, or if we you know, ask experts for help, or if we do some research, or if we start talking to board members and others in our network, whatever it is, there's an opportunity to move beyond that scarcity. And so that's why I just love kind of the power of that word yet.
Yes, I thought that was terrific how you talked about the Sesame Street song by Janelle Monáe, The Power of Yet. If you don't watch Sesame Street, you got to watch Sesame Street.
And so much that, truth. So much truth there.
So much truth. And that song is great. And I actually, we saw that, my family, and we for a while, we were singing that to my daughter. And we would say, she would say something like, I don't know how to climb rocks or something. And we'd say, that's the power of yet.
Yep.
And it really works. It's an amazing, I don't want to say reframe, but addition.
Yeah.
But yeah. I don't know how to climb rocks yet.
But I can learn.
But I can learn. But maybe I will if I want to. Yeah. The scarcity mindset really is something that lack that you talk about, that fear underneath it. I thought it was also helpful how you talked about the fear response, how you can either run away or freeze or punch somebody in the face really well, but that's not going to get you, you know, the social change. That doesn't move you closer to taking the action you want to be taking. Mm-hmm. So being kind of frozen or, you know, running away or lashing out are all real things I know I experience myself. And it's so frustrating, right, to be in that place instead of being in the healthy, positive, like vision-oriented place that we all want to be.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important not to deny the fear. The fear is very real, and I'm not at all suggesting sort of a Pollyannish approach to, you know, these intractable problems that social change leaders are working on. It's such a big burden. It's hard work, and so it absolutely makes sense that fear is going to go hand in hand with that. But the opportunity is to take a look at that fear, you know, see where it's coming from, and then attach that bridge to it to say, okay, well, can we move beyond that fear? Absolutely, the fear is here. I see there's a reason behind that fear, but can we open a possibility to something beyond that fear that's going to move us from this sort of deer in the headlights to something that's more positive and that's going to get us closer to where we want to go?
Right. So let's talk about the next chapter, Make Money Your New Best Friend, because certainly money, you know, money is such a proxy for everything else, all kinds of capital, time, political capital, ability to agency and ability to do things. So, you know, talk about how money is this tool that we should be not scared of and embracing.
Yeah. So yeah, that's the place to start again, is with the fear. I think so often in both the nonprofit and philanthropic sectors, money is very fearful. We don't really like to talk about it. It seems distasteful. It's uncomfortable. We feel like there's just never enough of it. It's just a whole lot of baggage around money. And so again, the opportunity is to sort of emerge from that baggage and recognize that there's nothing inherently wrong with money. There's nothing inherently fearful about it. In fact, it can be a fabulous tool to creating the social change you seek if we can sort of emerge from that. So for example, why is it that, you know, Amazon and Facebook and, you know, some of these large corporations, you know, money is just constantly flowing to them, but in the nonprofit sector and philanthropic sector, we're always sort of holding it back or resisting it. So I think the opportunity again is to recognize that, move beyond that fear, and start to think about money as a really exciting, game-changing thing, and to start asking questions like, why can't we start attracting the kind of money we truly need to achieve our social change goals, instead of this sort of band-aid approach to money that I think so often happens in the sector. Oh, we'll just kind of see how much we can get away with getting out of folks and then do whatever we can with it, as opposed to saying, you know, what do we want to accomplish? What is our big social change goal? And how much money is it going to take to actually get there? And then start moving in that space.
Right. Like, you have this chart on here of where money and mission and competencies are like all over the place and trying to align those. And it made me think about how the idea of chasing the money, you know, nonprofit folks are constantly trying to say, oh, there's this request for proposals. Mm-hmm. How can we squeeze ourselves into the circle that they're creating, even though we're a square, and sort of chasing money instead of sort of having the money chase you. And they like, this is where we're going.
Yep.
You know, come on board or, you know, don't. But
yeah, come on board because we're changing the world and, right. You know, we need partners and equal players with this. So come invest with us.
Yeah. So, and that leads nicely into mobilizing your inside team and your outside network, which is the fifth pillar of the book. And you talk about sort of on the outside network, really engaging funders as partners, as allies, as kind of aligned investors. Can you talk a little bit about that and whatever else you want to share about mobilizing people?
Yeah. So I think the true opportunity here in as it relates to money is to start to treat your funders as your equal. And I know, you know, that may sound interesting and kind of neat, but probably not ever going to happen. I would argue that it's the only way to go. If we truly want to create social change, if we truly want to fix the many broken systems that, frankly, the pandemic has uncovered, in our society and in our world. If we truly want to do that, it's going to take lots and lots and lots of money. And it's going to take folks partnering on the money side and on the solution side to really do things differently. And so I think the opportunity once nonprofit leaders fully step into their own power, reclaim that power, is to start to say to their funders and to be with their funders in a position of true equality. Instead of sort of shrinking from funders or fearing funders or worrying about them or bending over backwards to, you know, make them feel good and get what they need, instead coming at it from a place of true equality. And so when a funder tries to push back on your mission or distract you or have you fund a different way or do something in a different way, getting back to, you know, no, this is what we want to accomplish. These are social change goals. We would love to have you partner with us in this, but if it's not right for you, great. We'll move on and find other folks that this can be a true equal partnership with.
And do you want to say something about how the book really kind of speaks to an audience of executive directors, I think is that's how I received it. Tell me if I'm wrong about that. But any pointers on working with their staff internally and getting that alignment and mobilization?
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually would argue that the book is directed to all social change leaders. So that includes, you know, program officers and foundations or CEOs of philanthropy and government decision makers, anyone that's moving people or money to social change. And again, the reason I make that distinction, Rusty, is because, you know, I think so often when folks talk about how do we fix the nonprofit sector? How do we fix social change? We focus on the nonprofit leaders. And that's absolutely part of the equation. But we all have to move beyond scarcity. You know, all of us that are touching the sector in some way have to move beyond that scarcity thinking. And so all of these things that I talk about, including mobilizing your network, applies to, you know, philanthropic leaders and others as well. It's getting beyond that scarcity thinking of, it's all up to me, I don't have enough, I'm not sure how to do this. Instead, breaking that open and saying, you know, who else is out there that is, you know, has maybe some similar goals? Maybe they don't have the exact mission, but they kind of are aligned in my thinking or my worldview. How could we partner with them? How could we collaborate? How could we build a network of people and organizations that are all moving towards something much larger than our individual organizations? That's how you truly start to mobilize. And again, it has to happen all over the social change sector, not just in nonprofit organizations, but we need networks of philanthropists. We need networks of philanthropists and nonprofits and governments working together. We need all of it.
We need all of it, and we can have all of it with abundance thinking, right?
That's right.
it's sort of like change your mind, change the world, or change your attitude, and the rest will follow. It's a very powerful line of thinking.
Yeah. My conclusion is titled Change Yourself, Change the Sector, Change the World. So that's what I believe is, you know, you start with yourself, and then you start to sort of emanate this new worldview to those around you.
So how can folks find you and find the book?
So my website is socialvelocity.net. And the book, as you said, Reinventing Social Change, is available on Amazon, Bookshop, all the major book retailers.
Terrific. Well, Nell, I'm excited to reread it and reread it. There's so many things we couldn't cover in this short time that are in the book, really concrete exercises and stories from so many of your clients. And it really is an easy read. It is not a heavy academic kind of scholarly book, but it is well-sourced and well thought through and well written. So thank you for sharing it with our audience today. Now,
thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And good luck with getting it out there.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Fund the People, a podcast with me, Rusty Stahl, where we amplify how and why philanthropy should support the nonprofit workforce. For links to the resources that were mentioned in this episode, check out our show notes and more at fundthepeople.org/podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show. And if you enjoyed the episode or you're a regular listener, please share the podcast with your network or at least with one or two colleagues who you believe would find it valuable. Thanks for all you do every day for our community and our country through your nonprofit work. Stick with it, keep your tank full, and take care of one another.